Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, Ian Dark and John Rawling as always. Guys, we are here today, we are gathered today to talk about the state of the nation. We're here to talk about the state of boxing as we find it today. I have had a bone of contention with boxing for longer than I care to imagine, but you guys might have a slightly different view on it to me. John, is it in rude health as I keep reading, or is it just quite frankly rude?
I don't think you can say it's in rude health. I think the fact that humongous amounts of money have been made from a fight over the weekend vis-a-vis Fury and Paul, huge amounts of money have been made from something which really is an undercard fight, which you'd be expecting to see at 7 o'clock in the evening on a significant bill, I think is absolutely staggering. Maybe it's an indication of how the world's changed, and therefore, you know, promoters are merely capitalizing on the whole social media phenomena. But I think when a fight of that type is making more money than most good pros in Britain could ever hope to see, I think is profoundly worrying.
Ian, how about you? I mean, let's start with Sunday night's efforts in Saudi Arabia then. What was your take on it? Because you have a slightly more distanced view than us, given that you were covering boxing in the 80s and 90s. And I think you voluntarily say... You don't follow it as closely as you do, but you can't. You'd have to be going out of your way to avoid what happened on Sunday night.
Well, yeah, it got massive publicity. John's right. It was just an undercard fight, dressed up with a lot of trimmings and hyped to the heavens, and it made a lot of money. And people are going to say, we're just dinosaurs. They will. They'll listen to this and say, we're dinosaurs. This is the way of the world. The kids love the whole YouTube phenomenon. They think people like Jake Paul are huge stars. And I suppose they are. They are to a generation. So, you know, it's a lurch of boxing away from all the traditional values that we've mostly cherished over the years towards a kind of showbiz event. Is it good for the sport? Does it mean that the sport is going down the plug hole? I'm not absolutely certain, because people have been saying, you know, since, you know, it's like the old Burt Sugar line, you know, the great old American pundit who used to say, you know, boxing ran out of reputation in 1910. So I don't know whether it is. Things are changing, that's for certain. And John's right. It is obscene that a guy who can work so hard and really pay his dues in the business and get his chance and has a lot less money for his work than the two guys who went in the ring on Sunday. Not that I blame those two guys, because any way you can make money in this world, and you know, you're not a coward getting through the rings to have any kind of fight, well, good luck to them. But yeah, it is a concern.
It's not so much, you know, I mean, it's just that they get the level of publicity that they do. You know, I mean, I don't blame the television companies. I don't blame people for shoving it on as a pay-per-view event. If there's people who buy it, then fair be it. But, you know, I mean, we're talking about the state of boxing. Is it good for boxing? Is boxing thriving when something like this is making so much more and gaining so much more attention than very much more worthwhile contests? Then I think it's very difficult to argue that it is in good state of health.
It's so difficult, John, though, because here we are giving oxygen to it, you know, and it's so you can't avoid it. You know, it's so big and it's such a divisive thing. You can't not talk about it. We're here to, rather than talking about, you know, a club show in Barnsley last weekend, we're talking about the big fight in Saudi. Are we part of the problem?
Well, you could argue that, but I think the level of dislike for it among professional boxers says it for itself. Okay, there were big names who were there watching. You know, Mike Tyson was there, Deontay Wilder was there, Fury was there, and one or two others. You know, this is and they've kind of still revel in the publicity, and they need the publicity one way or another to keep themselves marketable. So they need to be around it. But you know, I mean, you only need to listen to somebody like Carl Froch, who absolutely trashed it. Then I think that is probably more what your average professional in this country is going to be saying today.
Well, also, I think it's probably fair to say people like Mike Tyson weren't there for free. I'm sure he didn't go there just for a holiday. Exactly. I'm sure there was a good few quid exchanged for that.
Yeah, I mean, people are going to these things now as like A-listers going to a celebrity event. And I think you're seeing a change in the kind of clientele in the crowds now. They'll go to a Tyson Fury fight or even a Dillian White fight, one of those Saturday night fights that's on the TV, as almost like we're going to be at an event and say we were there, have a few pints. You know, the sport can't be in that bad a shape if you're getting 80,000 crowds to see Froch and Groves, you know, open air at Wembley, or if you put Fury on against the Cleaners, you know, you'd probably get an 80,000 crowd somewhere as well at the moment. So not everything is awful, but there is a changing of the guard, I think, in the kind of people who go to the fights now. They're like the young guys who go to the darts. You know, I'm not sure how much of the darts they ever watch when they get there, but they sort of treat it like we're going to have a good night out. So it's not the kind of crowd we all got used to watching events at the York Hall, Bethnal Green.
So I've got to say, I've not watched one of the DAZN Misfits bills, which is obviously the YouTubers thing. It's obviously not my cup of tea as an archaic dinosaur purist. But one thing I read on social media was that when the last show was on, people were saying that it was packed even for the undercard, wherever it was. And that's something that boxing just doesn't have. You know, Ian, when you talk about these people cropping up, they're showing up for one fight, maybe two at most. They don't have any real interest in the whole bill. And I wonder if that's because that's something that boxing's not getting right in terms of the mix of skills, personalities, and maybe storylines even, and everything on a bill. I wonder if there are lessons that to be learned from other shows with boxing. I was thinking this at the Beterbiev Yard fight. Before that fight, there was Moses Hitalma had a blowout in I think a one punch blowout in about 20 seconds, and the fight before that, someone who I can't remember the name, someone was meant to knock out a journeyman. The journeyman lasted the 6 or 8 or even 10 round distance, and it was an exceptionally dull fight that, you know, caused 15,000 people to just about nod off at 10 p.m. I don't know if something needs to be done about the flow of these cards, where you have, right, we're going to have two good fights, two tear-ups. You know, they might be for an English title, they might be for a British title, but they're going to be evenly matched, and we know what we're going to get. We've also got these two talented prospects we've got to match. Let's get one guy a knockout, and let's get one guy some rounds under his belt. And then you've got the main event, and let's, you know, we've got to have a good co-feature. It's either a big name in a knockout fight or with a in an exciting fight or a good step up, and then you've got the main event. I don't know if we need to structure our bills more that way, so that you've got a bit more peak and trough rather than just a lot of trough and then one high peak at the end of the night. I don't know, John, any take on that?
Well, I'd agree with you. You know, I mean, it needs to be, the structure is worrying, isn't it? You know, and people say to me after you do an event or you watch an event, oh, that's a typical whichever promoter it is show. But let's be honest about it. They're all pretty much doing the same thing. Maybe certain events you get more than one big fight and more than one attractive fight. You know, you perhaps get a regional title, which sometimes wind up to be more inspiring than the main event. But I'd agree with you, Triz. There's not enough of those undercard fights often, which have real a real competitive feel about them. You know, I think
I think people want to see more than just a prospect beat down on somebody who really, let's be honest about it, is not there to win.
Yeah, and it's must be hard for you guys, Ian, as well. And you would have known this, particularly in the harsh landscape of an empty leisure centre. It's hard to create an atmosphere for these fights. You know, we're obviously being at these shows from 5 till 9 p.m. and people only really start coming in from about 9:30. And you've got to try and create some kind of occasion. And I'll add this to the Saudi thing on Sunday night. It sounded as dull as dishwater in the arena. But going back to where we were, there's no atmosphere in these places. Someone turned to me before the yard fight and said, "Oh my God, it's dead in here." And then the yard fight came, and obviously all the earlier sins of the evening were forgotten, and everyone had a great night, and the atmosphere did really perk up. But for the first few hours, it was tepid.
Yeah, I mean, but that's nothing new, is it? I've sat through loads and loads of shows at, you know, the Harvey Haddon Leisure Centre or somewhere in Nottingham, and you know, the undercard seems to be endless, and I had to commentate on nearly all of it as well in case the main event went short and we needed to fill the show up. So, you know, I could spend 4 hours commentating on basically what were mostly non-events with, you know, the house fighter fighting a guy who was, well, you know, he was breathing, but, you know, it was that kind of fight. if the guy who wasn't the house fighter put up a really good effort, and sometimes you thought he might have even nicked the decision, he very rarely got the decision. So it was all a bit predictable. So, I mean, that's not a new thing. I mean, what you described as the perfect bill there, it makes me think, Tris, that you should be a promoter. Because, you know, what you described would be fantastic. But putting that kind of thing together, I'm sure, you know, Eddie Hearn, Frank Warren, all of them will tell you, getting that kind of thing together isn't easy because the managers of these fighters, you know, basically want their up-and-coming prospects in not very demanding fights, don't they? They don't want them in big competitive matches too early. So getting enough in the undercard is, I mean, that's a big problem for the sport, I think. But, you know, you mentioned, I mean, we've been talking about the new Cleon Tao going in. I mean, what you talked about there is, you know, all right, they're into the YouTubers. Is there a way of involving them, the more mainstream fighters, you know, by improving the narrative around those undercard fighters? You can only really do that with stuff like those 24/7 documentaries that, you know, they started doing on HBO. So I don't know the answer. You probably can't, you know, because it's hard to get space in the newspapers or indeed on TV for that kind of promotion for the guys who are not the mainliners.
The yeah. WBC talked about rankings, didn't they? I mean, the winner of this, if had it been Paul, was going to get some sort of ranking, which in theory would give him the opportunity to go for a genuine title shot. But, you know, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? What do you do with Fury now? What do you do with Tommy Fury? If you send him towards a British title or an English title, in all probability, he's going to come across somebody who's going to give him an awful lot of problems. You know, put him in with Lyndon Arthur, for instance. I mean, it's very conceivable to see Tommy losing that fight by a distance. Put him in against Anthony Yard, he's going to get hammered. But you could see him being put in against another YouTuber. You know, there's this KSI guy out there, and you could see that happening. And if that happens, he's going to make a shit lot more money, isn't he, than he would do fighting for an English title.
It's a terrifying thought that one day Tris might be writing his books about the likes of Jake Paul and KSI. You know, some publisher's going to ring and say, "Can you do a who's who of the YouTube boxing fraternity?"
I mean, I do have a price, Ian, but I'm not sure I do for that. An A to Z. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's my cup of tea.
But I won't do that.
Yeah, but hey, you know what though? I mean, I'll say this, you know, I was never anti this fight. I was never anti Jake Paul and Tommy Fury. And I think, you know, John, yes, I think you hit the nail on the head. I was anti, you know, the gravitas afforded to it. It wasn't right. But I always thought this was sort of, you know, if obviously with Jake being where he's from, we couldn't have had it. But as an English title level fight at York Hall, no complaints. You know, two unmatched guys, two untested guys, you know, meeting early on in their career, what's not to like, you know, a bit of ambition, some personalities, and you know, fair enough. But obviously what it wasn't was a pay-per-view box office extravaganza featuring, you know, the likes of Ryan Garcia and Tank Davis and Crawford and Spence. And do you know what? I know they've just announced Garcia and Tank for April the 22nd this year. But had boxing had its house in order, had we been getting Crawford and Spence over the last couple of years, had we got Mayweather and Pacquiao circa 2010 rather than 2015, maybe there wouldn't be so much opportunity for people to gatecrash the sport and put on shows that are getting more popularity than the best that the promoters can muster at the present.
It puts it brings up a new sort of worry about the future of boxing, that, doesn't it, Triz? You know, you talk about those big fights not being made when they clearly should be made, and that's quite obviously one of the reasons that boxing, particularly in the United States, appears to be becoming increasingly marginalized and is struggling to get a mainstream audience.
Yeah, I mean, that is a huge issue, and I think we've mentioned it on these podcasts before. You speak to a lot of the young guys in America, and I do quite often because I do a lot of work on American TV and have done in the last decade. They've never seen boxing. They've never watched it. They never saw Oscar De La Hoya. They never saw Floyd Mayweather even, or Felix Trinidad, or any of those fighters, great fighters, because it was pay-per-view, because it was on HBO. It's been pay-per-view. The big fights in America have been pay-per-view now for the best part of 40 years. So the only way people would watch them is if they all got together and lumped together to pay the pay-per-view price, because the younger guys couldn't afford to do that on their own money. So the sport, bit by bit by bit in America, has been receding to become, you know, big fights in Las Vegas on pay-per-view TV. But, you know, the days when, you know, you read that book, The Black Lights, which I've just reread recently, Thomas House's brilliant book, you know, they were arguing about whether what dates they might get on CBS or ABC and, you know, the mainstream channels. Boxing isn't on the mainstream channels, as far as I know, in America anymore. I think ESPN Plus, which is a streaming service in America, did actually take that fight at the weekend, the Tommy Fury one.
Yeah, and I think it's a really difficult one, isn't it, John? Because, you know, when you look at Mayweather-Pacquiao, just as an example, obviously I said it would have been at its best probably 2009, 2010. We finally got it in 2015. When it actually happened, as a sporting contest, it was null and void. But commercially, it's the biggest fight in boxing history because they let it marinate for 5 or 6 years and it built and built and built. And even though as a sporting spectacle, it lost its luster, we can't argue with the bank balances and with the gate receipts and with the money it made. You know, it's smashed everything to smithereens financially. So are we in the wrong saying, oh, you know, it was 6 years too late? Because actually, it probably wouldn't have made, you know, maybe even half of what it eventually did. So are we wrong being dinosaur purists?
No, I don't think we are. I think you have a right to be a dinosaur purist, because the whole premise of this hour that we're talking about this week is whether these things are bad for boxing. And if you sit on fights again and again and again and put them back and put them back and put them back, you run the very real risk that they never happen, like Bowen Lewis, almost the case with Pacquiao and Mayweather. You know, by the time it happened, it may have made a lot of money, but a sporting contest, it was rubbish. And the further you go with Usyk and Fury, the more you wonder when it's going to be made. And you wonder now whether Joshua and Fury, having been not seized at the time when it was most marketable, having not been seized, you wonder now whether the chances of that happening have gone altogether. And I think that, you know, from boxing's point of view, okay, you get some which you hang on to, which make enormous amounts of money, as Mayweather and Pacquiao did. But I think just considering the health of boxing, I think surely everybody would agree that it had to have been better to have made that fight when those two lads were in their prime rather than when they were borderline washed up.
Well, you can throw in a few more, can't you? Riddick Bowe never fought Lennox Lewis, did he? You know, we waited a long time for Lennox to fight Mike Tyson. That was way too late as well. I suppose on a British level, that we were always talking about Cal Brook and Amir Khan, you know, and that happened right at the end of Khan's career in the end. But Triss is right. Those fights, because they're such established names, still do make the money. They're commercial successes. But, you know, I think fans, and you've got to reach out maybe across the divide, you know, just not the boxing aficionados, and reach out to the casuals a little bit as well. They see a world where Liverpool play Manchester United every season. You know they're going to play them twice every season. They expect to see the best taking on the best. And they don't always get that in boxing. And that is something else that's wrong with the sport.
Yeah, I'd say that Spence and Crawford's already a couple of years past its use-by date. But also, Ian, you were obviously around on the scene before us. But obviously in the 80s, when we romanticised Hearns, Hagler, Leonard and Duran, these guys weren't in their mid to late 30s and just scraping a few paydays. They were in their prime, mid-20s, tearing into one another for a decade.
Yeah, well, that was a vintage era, wasn't it? And, you know, Sugar Ray Leonard and Thomas Hearns, the 1981 fight, the showdown in Vegas. There, I mean, that was fantastic. Put that in the top five fights of all time for me, because it was those two right in their peak years as young boxers. So that was brilliant. And yeah, you know, credit to Bob Arum, who gets a lot of criticism, but all those fights in the 80s that people still talk about, you know, the Four Kings era, Hagler and Hearns and Leonard and Duran, all fighting each other in those mega fights. It was a golden era. They came along, you know, almost every year, something big. I was privileged enough to be at most of those fights as well. So yeah, if you can get back to something like that. But of course, you need four big megastars like that knocking around somewhere around the weight division for it all to happen, don't you?
Well, John, obviously, we've got at lightweight, we've got Teofimo Lopez, Devin Haney, if he can still make it. We've got Ryan Garcia, we've got Tank. There's a whole plethora of Shakur Stevenson. So the lightweights do have that sort of ability to do that. But it's the politics now, isn't it? And I suppose the thing is as well, going back to where Ian was, is when you think of the Fabulous Four, there's really not an asterisk by any of those fighters or their bouts with one another. But when you think of Pacquiao and Mayweather, there's an asterisk next to that fight because you know they were done. You know that they were nearer the end. And it's the same thing with the Mike Tyson, Lennox Lewis thing. There's still an asterisk by it. Yes, you sort of found out who did win, but you don't know who would have won had they been in their primes. And I think it's the same thing with Pacquiao and Mayweather. John, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, if Bob Arum had got those fighters now, if you could bring Hagler, Hearns, Duran, Leonard up to the current era, would they all have been fighting them each other now as they were then? And I think the answer to that is no, because you've now got the proliferation of television channels. You know, in this country, we've got Sky, BT, DAZN. In the States, they've got ESPN and others. You know, you've got the proliferation of channels. Therefore, it's not in the interests of these guys to go in against each other. So I think television and the change in technology, I think that's changed the landscape so much that's another reason why you're not getting the major fights happening. But boxing's losing out. And it's why martial art, you know, the MMA, why that's gaining, particularly in the United States, at the expense of boxing.
But I think on the flip side, I think the good thing is that on the female side of the sport is flourishing. And from the ladies I've spoken to in the game now, Clarissa Shields, Michaela Meyer, all of the top girls, they want to fight one another because they want to bring the sport up. You know, whereas when you look at the men and the arguments and the pettiness of A side and B side, who walks first and who wears what color shorts and all the rest of it, they sort of seem to go out of their way to avoid fighting one another. I don't use that word avoid lightly, but they certainly make it very, very difficult on the business side, don't they, Ian? It's very, very different to, people who like an Oscar. Oscar's a great example because the guy fought everyone. He fought King fighters. He fought Golden Boy guys. He fought top rank guys. He fought everybody. And, you know, when you look at through the rankings now, who do you see like that in any division who's fighting everyone?
Yeah, I mean, it's good to see that the progress that women's boxing has made, but that is a sort of like a seller's market, isn't it? They've got to make that attractive all the time to keep selling it as TV events. So, yeah, that is kind of booming a little bit. But I think a lot of the problem, I've often thought that the TV companies themselves, and I speak as someone who works in television, like John, sometimes we've been to blame for some of these big fights not actually happening because we've continued to pay these star fighters and these champions to have softish defenses against guys ranked number 9 or 10 in the rankings with not much chance of beating them, just to fill the TV date rather than saying not a penny more, not a dollar more until you fight, you know, the guy we all need you to fight. So that went on for years, really. So everybody nobody wants to kill the goose that's laying the golden egg, do they? Certainly on the promotional side, if you've got a fighter, or if I had a fighter and I was his manager or promoter, I'd be looking to keep him at the top as long as possible, rather than maybe risking him, you know, losing it all in a fight with, you know, the other guy's champion, the other organization's champion.
Yeah, the promoters on the sport rather than the organizations, though. That's, you know, that's kind of always been the point, isn't it? The organizations don't have sufficient clout to make the big fights happen. And also, do they really want it? You know, does the WBC want their champion to be beaten by the guy who's top of the WBA?
No. Yeah, and I suppose the thing is as well, when you look at going back slightly to the Fury Paul fight, is what really sells, isn't just a grudge and a storyline, but it's actually jeopardy about who's going to win a sporting event, right? Surely that is the very crux of any sporting event, is you're going to watch a game or a fight or a match or whatever it is because you don't know what the outcome's going to be. And that's where the level of intrigue and interest comes from. And too often, you know, where the best don't fight the best, there's no jeopardy. You're thinking, well, we know what's going to happen. And, you know, that's a hard thing to, you know, you've got to be a hardcore person to motivate, to watch something, to tune into something where you sort of know the outcome already.
Well, that's happening, isn't it? What about Tyson Fury, Derek Chisora again? Everybody knew the outcome to that. What was the crowd?
Yeah, true, true. But then you go to that thing where people want to be seen there. You know, you want to be one of the thousands at this event. So it's a strange one. I mean, you make a great point because, you know, there were a lot of boxing insiders who turned away from that, didn't watch it, didn't cover it, wouldn't cover it. But there were still tens of thousands that wanted to be seen to be at that public execution.
Yeah, well, if you still had public executions, no doubt they'd put those on pay-per-view and they'd sell as well. So, you know, I mean, just whether something is marketable isn't the test of whether it's a good sporting contest.
No, true. But then I suppose, you know, there's so much that boxing hasn't done to help itself over the years. And, you know, I suppose one of the ones that we've kept going back to was Evander Holyfield and Lennox Lewis and the judging and the points and scoring. And more recently, we obviously had that horrific one with Jack Catterall and Josh Taylor. And, you know, these scorecards, even again, we'll refer back to Tommy Fury and Jake Paul. How a judge scored for Jake Paul, I've got no idea. You know, I thought the rounds were very, very obvious how to score them.
Well, it's ridiculous, isn't it? The scoring rows that have gone on, you know, in the modern era, and you can go back to Hagler moaning about, you know, only being given a draw with Vito Antuofermo. I watched back that Josh Taylor, Jack Catterall fight out of interest the other day, you know, to see if I saw it any differently. And frankly, anyone who thought that Catterall didn't win that fight really should never judge another fight again. Or they should be taken and put in front of a panel somewhere and said, how on earth have you come up with this? No, please don't darken our doorstep again. And what are they telling the judges about how to score the fights? You know, what are they scoring? So you've got guys just kind of making up their own ideas of what they like. So some guy's going to like the silky stylist. Another guy's going to like the walk forward brawler and score accordingly. So it's not fair on the fighters. The fighters themselves need to know how the judges are scoring the fight and how they adapt their tactics to meet that. And this is why we're getting these crazy discrepancies and weird decisions. And, you know, I've seen reporters who've covered the sport for years in America throw down their pens, as I've done at the end of some fights when you've heard the decision, and thought, what is the point? What an own goal for the sport. And it happens way, way too often. We weren't watching that fight, so I can't have a clear view on the Jake Paul, Tommy Fury. But from everything I heard about it, it sounded bizarre that anybody could have scored it for the YouTube guy.
Well, I just think, you know, I had the worst experience I saw was when Canelo was given a draw against Mayweather by CJ Ross. And I don't think CJ Ross was allowed to officiate again, but it was one of those where, you know, like you said, Ian, I basically threw down my notepad and thought, how do I justify this in Boxing News next week? You know, that was one of the most complete performances I've ever seen. Mayweather took Canelo to school. It was absolutely magnificent. Canelo hardly laid a glove on him. And it was a draw. It was a draw. I mean, it was about as far-fetched as, you know, I just had to think there had to be some kind of error in there in some way, shape or form. You know, but I just don't know. Sorry, John, I cut you off there.
I was going to say exactly the same. You know, how anybody, I was actually, you took the words out of my mouth, you know, how anybody could possibly say that Floyd Mayweather had not beaten Alvarez, I thought was absolutely staggering. You know, I mean, Mayweather won every aspect of the fight. It was somebody who was boxing at one level against a guy who was boxing at another level, and he'd been good enough to that point. But when he moved up to the level beyond, he was absolutely beaten comprehensively in all aspects. And anybody who couldn't see that, you know, how the hell do these people get close to a fight? How do they become judges? It's blowing.
But that's a key question. I mean, all of this does drain boxing's credibility, doesn't it? It really does. You know, I think you and I, John, have had the conversation. You know, we bumped into a very well-known referee in Las Vegas who told us Mike Tyson would never lose the decision in that town. So are we talking about corruption or incompetence with these decisions?
Well, you're talking about the momentum of commercial success, aren't you? I think that's, you know, Canelo in recent years has been much the same, hasn't he? You know, they make so much money out of Alvarez. It's not a commercially sound decision to have him losing a fight to Golovkin, because Golovkin, you know, in promotional terms, he doesn't bring as much to the table. And therefore, everything is stacked in the home fighter's favour.
Well, and do you remember when Oscar De La Hoya got that decision against Felix Sturm? Because, you know, they already had eyes on the De La Hoya-Hopkins fight. And Sturm's face didn't fit. And then going to Sturm, obviously, God, that's even before we start getting to hometown decisions in Germany. And I've got to say, in the UK and the hometown decisions, like you said, Ian, at the start, really, with the prospect of the house fighter, we kind of, you know, I don't know if there's an acceptance, but we kind of all know it happens. Well, I mean, we know it all happens regularly. It's some of the decisions. You know, Macklin and Sturm is one that stands out, consistency, but then Robin Reed, and, you know, how he was shafted out of a title or two on the road. And there have been some absolutely horrendous ones.
Yeah, but what's anybody doing about it?
Having a moan about it on Ringside Rewind here 20 years later.
That's it. You know, I mean, we're purists who want to see it all done on an above board, even keel level, but these problems have been going on for quite some time, haven't they? I mean, you know, you go back it's hard to believe it now, but they used to let the boxing correspondents decide the decisions, didn't they, in New York?
Newspaper decisions, Quebec.
Newspaper decisions in the 1950s. Imagine that.
And promoters used to shove envelopes on the chairs, didn't they? Stuffed with money to make sure that they got the judge that they want, the judgment that they wanted from the hack involved. You know, I mean, it's always it's part of, I suppose, really, it's part of why some people are attracted to boxing. The sort of the rigmaroles around it. I'm fighting to find a word other than corruption, but the sort of the maneuvering around boxing is part of what makes it appealing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't, you know, nobody ever gave us an envelope. We're only bitter, aren't we?
few hundred quid would have shut us right up. No, and I suppose obviously we'll segue onto the PED things here. Now's as good a time as any because, you know, there've been so many bad things that have happened to the sport now, but it does seem that PEDs are accepted in the sport. You know, I'm not sure if I've mentioned on this podcast before, but, you know, when you look at the Hall of Fame ballot, and recently we've had Roy Jones go in, James Toney go in, Shane Mosley go in, all first ballot inductees without a thought that they've all failed tests. You know, it's all like, and I don't know if they're thinking, well, we've let in murderous rapists, so maybe we should let in people who fail tests. But like, you know, it's not even a line in a Hall of Fame bio that, you know, oh, by the way, they actually failed some PED tests while they were fighting. It just seems accepted that people have taken the tests and off you carry, you know, you carry on. In fact, obviously we found, obviously with bans being backdated and so short that they don't interfere with people who fight a couple of times a year, that there's not even a punishment really if you are an active fighter in this day and age, or if you are punished, you'll just go and fight somewhere else under a different jurisdiction. I mean, that's another loophole that really doesn't allow the sport to be passionately followed, I think, by people, Ian.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look at all the different commissions going on state by state in the United States, all with different rules and regulations and not enough checking and the rest of it. It's a bit of a lawless world, really, out there. And as you say, you know, somebody's failed a drug test, should they ever be inducted into a Hall of Fame? I would argue they shouldn't. No, they should be disqualified from that. It's a bit like athletics, isn't it? I remember, you know, I used to cover a bit of athletics, as John did as well, in the summer. And looking at the rostrum for the Olympic Games shot put, and both the gold, silver, and bronze medalists were all athletes who in the past had been banned for taking steroids. Now, you know, I made a big mention of it in my coverage, but I watched back the BBC TV highlights of it later, and I don't know whether it was a policy of theirs not to be getting involved in the whole drugs thing, but it didn't get a mention.
Well, that's shameful, but you know, it happens elsewhere, doesn't it, Ian? You know, it happens in coverage of football, where issues don't get recognised and talked about. Sometimes, maybe because there are television contracts which are being protected, and it doesn't maybe suit the long term good of the particular channel who's involved in it to confront it and talk about problems associated with it. You know, I mean, it's kind of always gone on, isn't it? And the fact that boxing has these negative tests and yet people are hastened back into competition, you know, you're only one 10-egg omelette away from getting back into it.
But you hit probably an interesting point. You know, we're talking about all the imperfections of boxing, and there are many, but I think those imperfections, you're right, you know, it being the sort of ghetto sport and all that, is part of its appeal, weirdly. So discuss.
Well, it's murky, isn't it, I think is a good word.
Not for me.
I just don't see it, because I just think it can be so much more. And I think, you know, the pure side of it, really, you know, if you think everything it does for communities, for lost souls, for people going down the wrong path in life, I think as a force for good, it's so much more powerful and empowering than what it is at the highest level, where, you know, there's all the backbiting, arguing, politics and everything else. And I think the PED things, it really grates on me more and more, the fact that it does seem to be lawless. And that there, again, you know, Ian, you mentioned the governing bodies. Obviously, there's different testing bodies with WADA, USADA, UCAD, VADA. You know, and some of those do apply penalties, and some of them can or can't, and some of them will or won't. It's an incredibly confusing landscape that, again, doesn't help the sport's popularity or standing, because no one really knows what's going on, you know, unless you really do know your onions, you know. Oh. and your average person, your casual sports fan, your everyday sports fan, won't know if they're coming or going, if they're trying to follow the sport.
And how can you, with a straight face, you know, this is another thing, isn't it? Conor Benn's drugs ban, the WBC saying, oh, it's all okay, you just had too many eggs, too many omelets. I mean, really?
Well, this is the thing. So, you know, it's been a long time since I've heard anyone hold their hands up in any sport and say, yes, it was me, I did it. It was me the whole time. You know, there's been the tainted meat, there's been the wild boar, there's been the protein shakes that have been spiked, there's been the tea that's been consumed. And one, you know, I don't know how anyone can point to what it is. You know, if any of us three failed a PED test for anything, I'm sure that we couldn't then say, oh yeah, it was that steak I had 3.5 weeks ago. You know, I don't, how would you even begin to pinpoint, you know, it was something that you've eaten? You know, I just it beggars belief.
It does. I mean, you know, but it's another thing that makes people look on at the sport in a cynical way. But, you know, here's a counterbalance. All the years that I've sat ringside commentating on boxing, I've got to say, you know, for 98% of the guys I covered, it was a privilege and a pleasure. You know, I was in awe of their bravery, their almost insane courage. I mean, they are remarkable people, boxers. And that, I think, is the biggest thing that sport has got going for it, because, you know, they are fantastic athletes. And I think you're right. I love your view of it, Tris, because, you know, you want the very, very best for boxing, it to be portrayed in the best way. And it's a pity there aren't more people like you around who are leading that kind of charge. It's such a difficult environment to operate in and to affect that kind of change. But you're right, there is, maybe we need to now say, you know what, we don't want that murky ghetto sport now. We are going to try and make a sport that's fit to go on for the next half century.
Yeah, I think we are, you know, because there's a lot that we know about. And obviously, I've written a book, the book Damage, which, you know, you can buy it now.
Buy it.
But, you know, and I talk about some of the ills in boxing in that. But, you know, there is a lot that can be done with boxing to try and get ahead of the curve before the sport is taken away from us, the same way it could be taken away from the Olympics in 2028. And there's plenty of stuff that we can do to get ahead of it and start to make ourselves look less of a fool on a more regular basis would be a really good starting point.
Chris, who's going to do that? Who's going to make that happen? Because everybody's operating, and that's the other problem. Everyone in boxing is operating for their own self-interests.
Yeah, and I suppose the thing is as well, when you look at boxing, you know, what would you say, you know, the top, what, is it 0.5% or the top 1% make all of the money? And why should they share the money with the rest of the of the people when they're in that top, in that rarefied air? I don't know, but it's got to be that top, because it's got to be the top 1%, because they're the ones where all the money is, because the money isn't filtering down to the grassroots, to the small halls, in any way, shape or form. You know, obviously we've got people on undercards that have to sell thousands of pounds worth of tickets to even get a spot on a show because there's no money to pay them. So, you know, that money has to come. It's got to be the real movers and shakers, and short of calling out everyone, you know, we know who all the big money people are, the guys that do make 5, 10, 15, 20 million a fight, a show, or a year. Those are the guys that can make the change. And also TV networks, you know, those are the ones that can put money in the pot. But aside from that, because we've seen these organizations, you know, the one that Barry did with Colin McMillan and the, what was it, the Professional Boxers Association, you can have a huge number of people, but if there's no real huge financial backer to try and get these things up and running, they don't go. And I remember, I think that the British Boxing Board of Control actually wanted to create a pension fund several years ago, and Rob Smith said, do you know how many fighters wanted to put money into the pension pot? And I said, no, you know, do you have a figure? And he said, yes, I do. It's a round figure, zero. No one wanted to put money in a pension pot because they need to live from purse to purse without that kind of structure. So it is really difficult, Ian. I don't have an answer. If I could wave a magic wand, I would probably have someone like Margaret Goodman from VADA, Teddy Atlas, Thomas Hauser, David Berlin, a former New York State Athletic Commissioner, and a couple of other very wholesome people, Matt Christie at Boxing News, and I would probably form some sort of super committee with a set of guys and girls with hugely staunch moral values, and ask them to run the show.
Yeah, like an independent regulator almost, which is, you know, what they're talking about in football. But how long would it be, I wonder, before such an organisation made some ruling about something and they were got sued by some promoter?
Or the flip side of that, Ian, is we get this great federation or body up and running, we piss off someone by making a strict judgment, and they go and set off their own organisation, and then we've got splintered organisations again.
Yeah, we've got to try, though. And you miss your own name off that list, Tris. So, you know, we are electing you here on Ringside Rewind to the new governing body. Congratulations.
Sort it out.
Ain't it?
I love it. John, there's the Ringside Rewind t-shirt there. Sort it out.
Sort it out or buy it.
Yeah, you got a choice of two colours. You could have black and white, or white with black writing.
We'll get Ringside Rewind t-shirts made, and we'll get them sold on YouTube. We'll get Jake Paul and his mates to pluck.
Can you imagine Jake Paul holding up a t-shirt? Buy it now. It's life imitated art, or it's art imitated life, I'm not sure. So, John, let me ask you this, John. If you could wave a magic wand and change anything, what would it be? Would it be as simple as just getting the best to fight the best?
Well, yeah, that would be the ambition. That would be what I would love to see always. But unfortunately, the realist in me says it's not going to happen because of the promoters, because of the television companies, because of vested interests, and because, simply, there are just too many noses, mouths in the trough, trying to make money, trying to gorge themselves on the cash which comes into boxing. And I don't think that it's idealistic and it's what we want, but I just don't think it's ever going to happen. Which why, ultimately, long term good of boxing, it'll cling on, it'll survive as it always has done. But it's going to be a flawed product at every stage of the way, and people are going to be in a position to rain criticism down on it.
I mean, also, one thing we've not mentioned, Ian, and I'm not going to ask you about this, although I am going to ask you that magic one question in a second. We've managed to go almost an hour without even mentioning organised crime, Kinahan, or any of that stuff that's not really helped the sport massively from the outside looking in, certainly. That's another bit. It's been another thing that's seen boxing make headlines for the wrong reason over the last few years. But Ian, magic wand time, what do you think is the answer? Do you think it is more to do with the structure, or do you think it's as easy as promoters working together, or you know, fighters being more plucky with their own matchmaking and calling out and insisting on these big fights happening?
Well, all of the above. It would be great if all that could happen, but I'm a bit like John. Maybe I became too much of a cynic covering it for as long as I did. I think it will probably just continue in its own chaotic way. That's the reality. That's the truth of it, because there is just too much greed and short-termism and self-interest, really, I think, for it to be any other way. But Yeah, in an ideal world, you'd like to see the best fighters fighting each other for all the boxers to be extremely well looked after and paid properly and to emerge from the sport as healthy and as wealthy as they could possibly be. That's what you could only wish for every single fighter. And for that to happen as well, you need the top medical backup at every single venue where the sport goes on.
One good thing to come out of last weekend's fight, in inverted commas, in Saudi Arabia, is surely that, you know, they've made so much money, the rest of the sport, in order to remain viable, commercial, attractive, they've got to see, maybe, that they've got to put the biggest fights on in order to compete. Otherwise, these, frankly, somewhat ludicrous fights between celebrities are going to continue being more marketable than proper fights between people who can really do it.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, you think back, Conor McGregor and Mayweather, that made a lot of money, didn't it? And believe it or not, there were even people who thought Conor McGregor was going to win, which I think, you know, that was the best bet of all time, really, I think. I think Floyd Mayweather at one time became as easy to back as 3-1 on because of all these people on social media and YouTube and the rest of it piled onto Conor McGregor thinking he could beat Floyd Mayweather. Imagine that they did.
And then I think there were people afterwards that said that Mayweather didn't carry him either.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, righto. I mean, there were kids who just bought into it in a way which you just sort of thought, are you real? I can remember having an argument with a guy in my local boozer, and he said, oh, McGregor this, McGregor that. And I said, mate, forget it. I said, Floyd Mayweather's more likely to get hurt tripping out of his car, falling over a curb on his way into the arena than to get beaten by Conor McGregor. Conor McGregor couldn't hack it as a boxer in Dublin as a kid, and that's why he wound up in mixed martial arts, because as a boxer, he wasn't good enough. He's been very shrewd at marketing himself. He's made vast amounts of money, but he was never going to have a prayer against Mayweather.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I heard a load of people say that as well, and they, you know, they said to me, oh, you know what, the big punch that he had, and he was going to take Mayweather out. And I said, look, I've watched Floyd Mayweather all his career. They're fighting under the Queensbury rules. The best fighters on the planet could hardly lay a glove on him. You think this guy, who would never be good enough even to win a British title, is going to be able to make anything of him? You know,
on his pro debut.
Yeah, I mean, bizarre. But anyway, you know, we're digressing. But we may be talking about things like that, you know, going down the line more and more. That's the reality.
Well, guys, I've enjoyed this. I think it's been like therapy in some ways. As Larry Merchant, our learned friend, said, nothing will kill boxing, and nothing will save it. And I think I'm along those lines. Nothing will kill it. Nothing will save it. But there is plenty it can do to help itself. And I will always hold that opinion. Gents, this has been great. Like I said, it's been therapy for the soul. I do feel cleansed having had a bit of a conversation with you guys about
experience. That Larry Merchant always had the best lines, didn't he?
He was great. Always
good. There's always room for a good rant.
Yeah. Room for a rant. That could be a new podcast. Room for a rant with John Rawling.
That's great. Well, guys, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate your support on Ringside Rewind. If you could rate and review this podcast where you choose to listen to it and spread the word, we would hugely appreciate it. And we will be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.